Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CashFly.com. This is Floss Weekly with Chris DeBona, episode 14 for October 13th, 2006. Jeremy Allison of Samba. Floss Weekly is brought to you by Visa. Safer, better money. Life and TWiT takes Visa.
Welcome to Floss Weekly, everyone. And today we have Jeremy Allison and a crowd of Germans. Say hello, crowd of Germans.
Hi.
Hi.
Did you hear that?
They sound great. They sound
okay, good.
They sound wonderful.
Good. So if you guys want to spout off, resist the urge. And Jeremy so cool. is the most patient man in open source software.
It's free software.
So true. He... not only is he a brilliant developer and one of the best minds of our generation,
That's the Australian guy.
He has also been patient enough to let us record this now for the third time.
The first two times I asked who the Australian guy was, but now I know.
Yeah, so all the spontaneity is going to be served by us talking about Battlestar Galactica.
Before those who did not hear the previous three recordings, who is the guy in Australia?
The guy in Australia is Andrew Tridgell, better known as the smartest man in Australia, who is the actual original author of Samba.
Ah.
And in fact, I was the first person to send him a patch, and Volker here in the room was the second person to send him a patch.
So you're not completely worthless. That's great. Okay.
No, that's me and Volker. We're both together.
Well, honestly, everyone compared to Andrew Tridgell is kind of worthless because this guy is so flippin' smart. His PhD was in
gravity wave.
Gravity wavelets.
Oh my gosh! What was he doing writing open source software?
He was bored.
He got bored.
Wavelets, you know,
bored PhD students.
What you were not telling you is he took a break from Samba for how long?
Few years or so to write rsync.
He wrote rsync too.
No, I'm saying for his dissertation. He took a weekend off to finish his dissertation in gravity wavelet theory.
No, he actually he switched to computer science, or maybe this was his second one. I'm not actually sure. And rsync was his actual PhD dissertation.
Amazing.
So. Interesting.
Hey, I didn't know you could write a program and make that your PhD dissertation. That's kind of
You can if it's an important enough program.
And you're doing computer science.
And it's truly a computer scientist's program. I mean, the least common subset problem is actually one of the classic problems in computer science.
There's a lot of theory involved, too.
Yes.
But let's talk. We're here to talk today about Samba.
And about you, Jeremy.
It's all about Jeremy.
Thank you.
So originally, when the smartest man in Australia wrote Samba, what problem was he trying to solve?
Well, he had a Sun workstation. He had a DEC Pathworks program. And... he wanted to have his DOS PC talk to it, and he was kind of interested in how it worked, so he sniffed the network and wrote a version of the same protocol after looking at the network packets.
Like you do. First thing I think to do.
Wasn't that how TCP/IP was invented? Somebody woke up in the bath one morning and thought, I know how this will work. We'll do a packet switch network, you know?
Do we really want to talk about Vint Cerf and Bob his name in the bath? I mean, they're nice people. Don't get me wrong. But,
yeah. that's a place never, you probably don't want to go.
Never take a bath with a guy named Licklider. I just want to throw that in there.
Licklider?
The less we know about your personal life, Leo, the better.
We're going to get flamed again for this. All right. Go ahead.
So, so he wrote that, and he put it out there on the net, and it languished for about a year, I think. And then I was working for a company in the Valley doing customer service support software, and I was being forced to use PCNFS. I was porting their software to Windows NT, and I was being forced to use PCNFS, which I think actually does qualify as torture under the Geneva Conventions.
It's like waterboarding for computer scientists.
Yeah, it's a cruel and unusual punishment. You know, so I was trying to find a better way.
You're comparing like using software to being like having your genitals electrocuted.
Well, this is America after all.
Oh, you know. Okay, here we go.
There are many forms of cruelty and punishment, I think.
Yeah. So
what you're saying is you didn't like PCNFS.
I didn't like PCNFS. Okay. I used to have to support it at Sun too.
Yeah.
So once I saw this thing, I basically said, "Oh, this kind of does some of what I want to do." But the networking sucked because apparently it was his very first networking program. Mm. So I promptly stole a bunch of IP from the software that we were writing commercially. And
this company's out of business now.
Yeah. They're bought by PeopleSoft, who are bought by Oracle. So it's all in the family now. all one big, happy Linux family. Yeah. It was just standard socket techniques. And I sent him a patch. And this, and Volker sent in some patches. And this
good old Volker.
Went on. Yeah, this went on for several years, actually. It just kind of grew from there, really.
Samba's used, just so people know, I mean, I'm sure most people who listen to this podcast know, but Samba's used everywhere as a way to network systems.
Can I explain it? I'd like to...
No, you can't explain it.
Oh, sorry.
No, please.
Well, I shall try. I like to refer to Samba as the glue that binds sort of Linux and Unix and Windows together. It's not as toxic as glue, but it has the same effect.
Well, for instance, if I'm using OS X and I share files with my Linux-based NAS and I share files with my Windows-based PC, and it all is running over Samba.
That's right, yeah. And in fact, Mac OS X ships Samba as their file server, as does Sun, IBM, any of the sort of sub-$1,000 NAS boxes that you can go in and buy, almost certainly they're running a version of Samba on top of some version of Linux or FreeBSD, so...
You get $12 for every one of those installations.
Well, I'm afraid not.
not a penny.
we get applause and acclaim. Actually, no, we don't. What we get is bugs. People send us
well, and that's just like millions of dollars, isn't it?
It's just what we like. You don't go into open source if you want to be rich, really, or free software.
What motivates? That's a great question. And I think a lot of people are puzzled. People who come from a more traditional background are puzzled why somebody would spend so many hours, work so hard, put up with so much grief.
That's simple. I'm a communist and I want to destroy the software.
You're a socialist.
We knew that.
Communist.
Sorry. So okay. Yeah. So I'm sorry, Chris. Sorry.
No, but really, what's in it for?
No, he really is a socialist.
Yeah.
Well, that's legit.
Look, from where I grew up in Sheffield,
which is the United Kingdom.
Yeah. The town council is socialist, or was before New Labour, but that's another story. But yeah, I mean, we used to be called the Independent Socialist Republic of South Yorkshire. So as soon as I saw the GPL, I recognized it for what it was. Hey, this is like a town council meeting. Unfortunately, unlike Berkeley, we don't get the naked guy showing up, but,
He died, he killed himself.
Really?
Yeah, the naked guy in Berkeley killed himself.
Sad.
Yeah, isn't that the...
So, yeah, he was a real character, but...
Not anymore.
So you do this out of a political motivation?
No, I do it because it's fun.
Yeah.
And I think Tridge and Volker do the same thing, do it for the same reason.
I don't want to, hammer on the socialism thing because a lot of people... Don't do it for that reason. But it is revealing in that about 8 years
open
ago,
source people.
Yeah. So about 8 years ago, Jeremy was sitting on stage with Linus Torvalds and Sunil Saxena from Intel, and there was a fourth
Larry
person,
Augustin.
Larry Augustin. He was the moderator, and then there was Mike Tiemann, right?
No, it wasn't Mike Tiemann. It was
Bob Ewing.
Bob Young. No, I think it was...
No?
It wasn't Bob Young. Someone from Red Hat.
Whatever.
My name was, because I can't remember.
Faceless and all that. Well, so they're sitting up there, and somebody says to them, don't you think all of this open source stuff is communist or socialist or something? And Jeremy looks over at Linus and looks over at Jeremy, and they're like, well we are socialists. Because Linus was from Finland, and Jeremy was from Sheffield. And, it was hilarious. Because, I think that,
In America, that's a bad word, but that's not... Yeah. The case in many
Europe.
Places.
In Europe, it's political philosophy. Yeah.
But anyways, but the point is, if you go and read did you ever see the OSDN SourceForge BCG study of motivations on SourceForge?
No, I didn't.
It was quite fascinating. It was done in 2002 and updated in 2004, and they're updating it again. And basically what they did is they went around to all the active projects on SourceForge and asked them why they did what they did. And it's actually quite fascinating because the number one reason isn't politics, isn't I hate Microsoft, isn't
any of
that
stuff.
I
better know what it is.
What is it?
It's to scratch their own itch. It's to do something that they need to do.
Well, that's one of the top three. I know that.
Oh. Because that's why I did it.
You needed it.
I needed it. Yeah. I was using PCNFS. I needed something better than that. You know?
Yeah, it's...
Oh, Chris is looking it up.
I'm actually going to bring it up.
Google.
Well, I'm really curious what the number one... I'm thinking having fun or an enjoyment of the... I would say here what I would guess. It's fun to program. You get the approval of your peers and the respect of your peers and to scratch their own itch. That seems like the top three, yeah?
Well, let's see if you're right. I'm bringing it up here.
Well, maybe
on screen.
It's the Spinal Tap. Having a good time all of the time. Okay.
Wait for it. Survey methodology. Motivations. Intellectually stimulating, i.e. having some fun.
Yep.
44% of the people said that was one of the reasons why they did it. Improved skill. 41% of the people said that they thought that's why they wanted to do it. 33.8% said they were doing it partly because of adding functionality to their jobs. And then only a third of them believed that code should be open.
Huh.
Then we go down to like 30% was like non-work functionality, i.e. personal use. And then 28%, they also felt they had an obligation to do so. And then there are other ones, like professional status, 18% of them thought that. Sure. Reputation in the open source world was like 11%.
I would have ranked that higher, but I guess not. Yeah.
You know,
and here's a really interesting one for me. Beat proprietary software, i.e. I hate Microsoft, things like that. It was only 11%.
Yeah.
So.
You know, I love watching Chris click through stuff on radio. It's really exciting.
That's good radio, isn't it, Jeremy?
We'll link to the survey for those readers who like me not Jeremy.
One thing it does point out.
JRA@samba.org. Say what a mean person he is.
That's my email address.
I'm sticking to it.
You can email me, whatever.
Well, one thing that does point out, though, there's a lot of these programmers come from proprietary companies and backgrounds and are still working proprietary software. This is just a side bit.
So the interesting thing about this, and this leads us on hopefully to our next topic, is the fact that...
Are we boring you?
Well, no, I'm just... No,
okay,
It's the fact that the reason the code is open, even though that isn't a primary motivation for most of the people, is in fact the licensing.
That's true.
And the GPL.
28% of them, I think.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it's actually... of the GPL that makes...
Well, I mean, this is also, we just talked with Evan, and we were talking about the GPL, and I mentioned in that broadcast, that had a lot to do with why the GPL does have the insanely large market position that it does have.
Yep.
So, which, as we've talked about, you and I, it's anywhere between 48 and 52%, depending on how you ask the question.
And why is that? I'm sure, sorry, I missed that.
Well, partly because, people like the license, but also partly because they're required to. If they use that software, if they derive richness from that software, they are then obligated to take part.
It's part of the license, in fact. So.
That's right.
So this is, in fact, why it always amuses me to see Microsoft compared to the Borg, because, to be honest, the thing that assimilates stuff is the GPL. The GPL is the Borg.
Could you not compare us to a genocidal race bent on human destruction?
Well,
I mean, just once?
I prefer the sort of, getting cool technology part of the Borg. That's, admit it, Chris.
That was something
you like those
liked.
Laser eye things and, the little on the end of the hand.
Understood, it's not get too far in science
before,
fiction,
But,
if they cut off his hand to put that thing on, how did he have to get his hand back?
Yeah, and what does he do with it? I mean, what is that thing for? Screwing his eyeglasses on? Because they only had a
Well, that laser needs adjusting.
You got a point.
But anyways, back to the Borg reference. So do you think that the GPL is more Borg-like than, say, Microsoft?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Right.
And in fact, that's probably one of the reasons why they absolutely dislike it so much. I mean, they're Well, I've just been at the CIFS conference. No, hatred is probably
okay.
at the CIFS conference, and there are a couple of Microsoft people there, and we chat in a
collegial
sort of way.
And then you report on podcasts about everything they say.
Well,
your articles and
their philosophy is basically the GPL is evil. you know, and we must stay away from it. And, you know, and that coming from where they are, that's perfectly understandable.
It's evil from their point of view. You bet.
Yeah, but if you're willing to join the community, so it's a community-based thing. You know, if you want to own your own community, the GPL is evil. Mm-hmm. If you want to join and
if you want to be part of
people,
something with your peers,
yeah, that's right. Then the GPL is a wonderful way of leveling the playing field. Nobody gets an unfair advantage with the GPL, mm-hmm. and that's just not true of things like the BSD or the MIT licenses.
You know,
everybody kind of shares, but people can still take out and you know.
I obviously don't have a problem with that. You know, we use the BSD and the Apache license a lot.
For certain things, it's absolutely right. But it's like, so for instance, one of the things that very few people know is NetApp originally started with a version of FreeBSD.
Okay.
You know what I mean? And if you look at it...
Well, so did Sam.
How much have they actually contributed back to BSD? And the answer is absolutely zero.
Okay.
NetApp do contribute back, but they contribute back to Linux.
Mm. Why is that? That's kind of weird. No?
Well, because they're obliged to, because of the GPL.
Oh, well, are they actually using Linux on there? So I'm totally uneducated
about storage. They're not using Linux on their actual storage itself, but they know that a very strong Linux ecosystem, NFS clients, sells more NFS servers.
Which
so they
is what
fund
they
someone
sell.
To
right. make NFS
the
better.
Linux NFS client code.
So, fascinating.
Yeah. Okay.
So there you go.
Yeah.
Where is the state of Samba right now? I mean,
We have SMB2 coming out. Is Samba? Well, let's start earlier. How's Samba doing?
Okay. Well, we have a production version of Samba, which is Samba 3, which is what most of us here in this room work on. Then we have what I like to refer to as the research arm of Samba, which is Samba 4. Which is essentially developing the new technologies that you know we then shamelessly backport into the production version once we like them and we think they're working enough. And the SMB2 stuff is part of that. I think Volker's thinking about moving that back. So Tridge goes basically working with Tridge is like I say it's like a small dog trying to work with a human set of small dogs trying to run with a human being. He tends to he tends to outpace you intellectually, so it's kind of easier for him to do a lot of the research stuff in a separate branch, mm-hmm. And then you know the plodders
and the plodders
as the wonderful Sheffield saying says, after the Lord Mayor's parade comes the muck cart to clean up after the horses. So then the plodders come along.
So you're the muckraker.
You know, yeah, basically we clean up the horse manure and put it in the you know in the cart. So
you're really you know I mean it's fun to laud Andrew like this, but I mean I think you're kind of selling yourselves short.
Well,
okay, so
no, I
so
mean,
it's cute,
no,
but I want the listeners to know that
well we productize
you're non-trivial you know that
well kind of all right
non-trivial is that a backhanded compliment or what
we productize I think probably is the best way of putting it. I mean Tridge is wonderful at doing you know the research stuff and working out how things work, but then actually sitting something out there on you know tens of millions of servers, which is what we have. You know, that's kind of what we're better at, I think. Mm-hmm. He's actually making stuff that's robust enough and trustworthy enough for tens of millions of users to actually run their production file servers on.
So, gotcha.
Yeah, so there's just a lot of work going on in Samba right now. Basically, it was very interesting. The SIFS conference we had just
SIFS, recently, by the way, is common.
SIFS is Common Internet File System because it's not a file system. You would never ever run it over the internet, but it is fairly common. So hey, one out of four isn't so bad.
Now I have to say that if somebody doesn't know the ins and outs of this, it's all very confusing. So Samba is not a file system.
No, it's actually a file server. So okay, let's go back to basics. You got your Windows box.
Yeah.
You double click on your network neighborhood or whatever it is they call it in Vista, my network neighborhood or you know more whatever.
I think they took the my off in the Vista.
I think actually, Windows as it ships now doesn't even have that on the desktop anymore.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, people kind of remember it though. But my network places.
That's what it says on my XP. Yeah, my network places. Yeah.
So you bring that up and you see a bunch of resources and they can be file servers, they can, you know, they're remote storage or remote printers or whatever, mm-hmm. right? Now, those things are running the SMB or SIFS protocol, which is what Windows uses to communicate with remote storage and printers and authentication. So those things can be Windows servers, they can be Samba servers, they can be EMC or NetApp. I mean, they're really the main four creators of that kind of code. And there used to be many, many more, but what really has happened is this kind of product, the standalone file server, has become a commodity. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the days of the NetApp starting up with a brand new file serving product are probably gone. So these days, you know, people are just churning out real cheap file server boxes running Linux and Samba, or, you know, obviously EMC and NetApp don't license their servers down that low. And Microsoft would like to, but they still charge a horrendous amount for a Windows license. So most of the low-end stuff is actually Linux and Samba. So the CIFS conference actually was reasonably poorly attended because, to be honest, if you're not running a Windows file server or your EMC or NetApp, everything else is Samba. So it's essentially become a commodity product. Just like Linux really has become a commodity operating system, that is shipped by, you know, companies.
We have a couple copies here.
Google is a mild user.
Hey,
of
you heard we hired Andrew, right? Andrew Morton.
Oh yeah, that's right. No, yeah, so he's you guys got a maintainer.
Yeah, it's very handy.
Yeah, so I mean, in the same way that, you know, Red Hat and Novell sell, you know, Linux.
Novell is where Jeremy works, by the way.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, and I was going to ask, because I used NetWare for years. Is Samba the equivalent of NetWare?
Yeah.
It's a non-commercial NetWare.
It's kind of a non-commercial NetWare, except that it uses the Microsoft protocol.
It's LAN manager.
It's LAN manager based. And in fact, you know, in many ways, it sucks a great deal more than NetWare did. Because the thing about NetWare that you know, Novell could take advantage of was that they could control the client and server, whereas we don't get to control the clients.
Oh, that's interesting.
Well, why not? You know, Microsoft doesn't let you into that.
No, that's got to be quite a challenge. That's got to be quite a challenge, because you don't know who's going to be talking to you or what they're going to ask or how they're going to act.
Yeah, so we have to be paranoid and we have to be safe and we have to be fast. So it's kind of fun. And in fact, we have Steve French, who's at IBM, who's writing the Linux CIFS client. So the goal is, so here's, you know,
which you can already do right now with SMB client, yeah?
Yeah, SMB client is essentially unmaintained in the Linux kernel.
Oh, okay.
So here's where, you know, I'm warning, boop, 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 possible commercial alert, right, coming. So I'm just warning people.
Is this where I start talking about Visa, the credit card? Oh, no, that's later. Sorry.
Do you want a break for a commercial there?
Yeah, well, you want to do a commercial alert? I'll tell you what, let me do my commercial, then you can do your commercial. How about that?
Wait, I have a commercial?
Yeah, you have a Visa commercial.
In fact, I do?
Yeah, you did last week.
That mean I get paid?
If you'd showed up for the last month, you would have had Visa commercials. You bet.
Well, Christ, wow. Leo.
All right, Leo, go ahead. You do your commercial spot.
Go ahead. Let's wait for our fine sponsors.
Actually, this is the last time that you'll be sponsored by Visa. So you kind of, you know, it was a short relationship, but a deeply felt one.
Well, if Jeremy hadn't acted so poorly, we maybe would have kept him.
Well, the interview with the stream of abuse probably just,
yeah,
you know.
The truth is that the Visa did a 1 month test campaign, which has been a huge success, and I'm sure they'll be back.
Good for them.
Reason they bought
good
the podcast
you,
is
you
they wanted hard. To spread the word that Visa is safer money on the internet, that, you know, you're protected, of course, when you make a purchase online with Visa. And they do a lot of fraud protection and so forth. So they just wanted to get the word out.
Wait, is this the commercial?
Yeah. Safer, better money, life, and Twit takes Visa. That's it. That's all. That's how painless it was. And you've made 53.
We didn't realize we were doing a commercial.
You've made 53 cents. So congratulations.
I guess
53 cents.
No, I'm sure it's more than that. I haven't calculated it all out. It actually depends.
Whatever. I mean, it's the word Visa. Yeah.
No, that's really true. As long as I say Visa,
you know,
Visa, Visa.
You know, people buy NetApps with Visa.
Now, I know you're a socialist, Jeremy, but that doesn't go so far as to preclude you using a credit card, I would hope.
Oh, no, certainly not. Hey, you can be socialist with credit cards. So,
sure.
You know.
Socialists
if you
take
think about
Visa.
It, credit cards are very socialist.
So that's my commercial announcement. You were going to make a commercial announcement.
Okay, I was going to talk about essentially Linux in a Windows world, because one of the things that Linux needs if it's going to be really successful is you need to have Linux on the desktop, right? So if you're going to put Linux on the desktop in corporations, what you need is a Linux that will actually fit into existing Microsoft networks. So I actually cheered up the NFS conference no end by giving them a talk called The Death of NFS.
they must have loved that.
Oh, they did. It was great. You
mostly because everyone who has to write that stuff wants to kill it.
I got to pick up all the fruit off the stage afterwards, too, which was kind of cool. The reason for that is essentially everybody's got Windows desktops, right? They're going to have Windows desktops for a reasonable amount into the future. So what that means is that the protocol that corporations speak to those desktops is SIFS or SMB, which is what Samba speaks. So if you're going to put Linux on the desktop, you have to have a Linux that actually fits into that in a really clean and elegant way. And that actually is what Gunther mainly, and also
Gunther's in the room.
Gunther's in the room here. Sorry, there's one of my Nivelle colleagues.
As is Lars.
Has actually been working on, which is the ability to take a Linux desktop, and this is free software. This is not Nivelle proprietary stuff. I mean, yeah, we implemented it on behalf of Nivelle, but it's gone into all the external trees. What it allows you to do is to put Linux desktops into Microsoft Active Directory domains or whatever, and have everything essentially just work on logon. So we put a lot of work into that. Do you want to say a few words about that, Gunther, just briefly, or
take the mic?
Yeah, just go. Yeah.
He's German.
So what we basically were doing just we received a lot of customer requests from all kind of people, from consultants and also from huge important customers, saying exactly what they are actually missing with all their solution. And of course it was possible to build a kind of similar thing just out of the components that are existing in the open source space. So we just had to identify what is exactly missing, what is the glue code that we currently do not have, and then we realized that we have a lot of very good stuff already running inside WinBind. We had a lot of beautiful infrastructure. We were able to communicate with the Active Directory domain controller. We were able to do Kerberos authentication, single sign-on, and that all that kind of stuff. But we were just not able to actually bring that to the desktop. So we had to look to the integration pieces. So we had to look for the login manager, for the PAM module stack, and all that kind of stuff, and had to just add little tweaks and little modifications here and there. And so finally, then we got there rather quickly. And then, of course, once we had the basic authentication, the single sign-on feeling actually working, we were just receiving more of a feature requests, because once you pass them a little finger, they want their whole arm. So people were asking about...
I think that must be a German phrase.
I think I'm sure it sounds wonderful in German, too.
So basically... If you're not technical, what Gunther was saying there is essentially you can take the Nivelle Linux desktop and it's got single sign-on in a Windows network.
Wait, and that's the finger?
That's the end of my commercial for the company that's just about to be delisted off the NASDAQ. Oh. Oops.
And Nivelle had a warning from the
from
the NASDAQ for not filing paperwork. That's what that was.
If you can't laugh at your own company, who can you laugh at?
It happens to everyone. It's no big deal.
Yeah,
it doesn't happen to everyone. It just happens to Nivelle and Dell.
Oh, come on. It's not as though we were bugging our own executives or anything.
Oh, yeah, that HP thing. Wow. You got there while the getting was good, huh?
how high does that go? Man, were they bugging Carly? Who
knows?
That's
what Mark Hurd said. You give them the finger and they start biting your arm off. It's just...
I couldn't believe that. I mean, wow. It's so dirty.
Well, it's real paranoia. You know, it happens to companies who think... So it's like with Nivelle, if the press want to talk to us, it's like, oh, thank God, some attention. You know, hey, we'll talk to you. You know, whereas when I was at HP, so I used to be at HP, which is why I can give them a kicking and not feel too bad about it, is that they used to, I remember, because I've had a bunch of friends in the press, and some of them were like, well, we're not allowed to talk to HP. HP has this real sort of control. How does our image appear in the press? So, you know, and I think it was that attempt to keep control of their image that led them down the path of essentially bugging their entire board. Hey, trustworthy bunch.
I trust
to run the company.
So one of the things I really want out of Floss Weekly when we talk to people like Jeremy is I want people to get a picture of what it's like to be a developer or even a free software developer at some of these companies and how weird it can be. Like HP, the stories that Jeremy would tell me about Roseville, this big complex I have up in Roseville, like never failed to just amaze me. And I've been doing computer industry now for 10 years.
Oh,
you have to tell them about the speakers.
The voice of God?
Yes.
Oh, well.
You have to tell them about that.
I mean, I don't want to rag on HP too much.
Well,
I mean,
no, but this is...
I could tell
the world has to know this.
What about the Sun story of the stage-managed Scott McNeely presentation.
Which one?
Well, the one where Scott McNeely was so paranoid about getting unfiltered questions from his employees, because he took questions from all around the world, right?
Yeah.
And they were all from Sun offices, but they were all from managers of Sun offices, right? But the one thing he couldn't... So this was at Shoreline Amphitheater, which is, if you don't know, is a large...
A big open-air
amphitheater in California here.
It's about a quarter mile away.
Yeah, and the one thing he couldn't do was filter the questions that were coming from his live audience.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
So, you know, when he said, do you have any questions from live audience? You know, the entire thing put the hand up, basically like, why do we suck so much sun? Why did you why did you spin the planets off? And this whole disaster, right? So he picks someone like five rows back and invites this poor woman on stage who's incredibly nervous and hands her the mic, and she starts to ask a question, and it turns into a completely scripted song and dance routine.
Really?
She was a ringer.
She was a ringer, and he was scared to have an unfiltered question from his employer.
Wow.
Because,
that's unfortunate.
God, they might ask something I don't want to answer. Mm-hmm. And I must admit, you know, I mean, Novell just isn't that organized.
They tried to bug people, but it didn't.
Well, you know.
It takes work. You have to fill the invoice out.
We just have people on meetings saying, you guys suck, to the exec committee. And, yeah, it's kind of fun. HP.
So the voice of God.
The voice of God. They have an entire speaker system in all HP offices.
Every last one of them.
And around the time of the quarterly results or whatever, you know, I'm sitting there working away, and all of a sudden, I hear classical music. And it's real faint.
This is straight out of 1984. This is what happens in the Soviet Union when a premier dies. They start playing classical music.
I'm like, where is this music coming from?
Because you're just sitting there, you're hacking away, you know, you're thinking about Sam.
And then all of a sudden, you know, Vivaldi's Four Seasons starts playing. Yeah. And I'm kind of looking around, and the music's getting louder and louder, and I finally identify this speaker in the ceiling. And then... You know,
with bullet holes
after it, after it gets loud enough, somebody basically says, you know, Carly will be addressing us in 5 minutes or whatever. The music keeps playing, and then they have, you know, and then Carly addresses the nation. You know, she gives the state of the quarterly results or whatever, and it's so weird because you have no contact with these people. I mean, they are just, you know. I used to take the HP plane out to Roseville, and that was where Carly used to keep her private jet. So I would see the private jets, and not I would never ever invite her on them. And I was sat there reading the local paper when a bunch of guys in power suits came in.
Power suits.
You know, I'm wearing my usual sort of shorts and t-shirt, and they start talking about I can't remember exactly what it was. It was about outsourcing to India or something, and they're. Some politician had been criticizing, you know, outsourcing and sort of firing everybody. And they were just listening to the conversation. They were going on about, oh, how politicians just didn't understand business. And if, you know, they really shouldn't be allowed to run the country because they just can't understand the economics of business. And, you know, I'm sat there and my hands are getting tighter and tighter on the paper. And I'm thinking, Chairman Mao was right. We should make them pay for the bullet we shoot them with. Just
up against the wall, gobbling.
These are very strange people. I mean, you know, the execs up there, they're just...
It's a different world.
Leo, they're not like you and
they're
me.
Not like
they're
me.
Not like you and me.
No, F. Scott Fitzgerald was right.
Yeah.
That's true.
That's that great... Right. That's that wonderful quote somebody said to him, they're very rich and not like you and me. Yes, they have more money.
I thought that was H.L. Mencken. It was F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Yeah, I can't remember. But,
but you know, we got off the rails here a bit. So,
we did?
So, yeah, we did, because we were talking about Samba and how fabulous it is.
Yes. And how fabulous my employer is.
And so now... Yes. No, that's not what it is.
Oh, sorry, whatever.
Listen, I know you like working there or you wouldn't work there.
That's true. It is kind of fun.
But what was I saying? SMB2. So we're going into the world where Vista is coming out. It's got a new thing going on. Are you guys going to be compatible?
Okay. So this is where you're going to... I'm going to use the bad word, right? And I'm telling you in advance. Okay. So you can...
Do we have the capability to beep people or should I just go beep?
I beep them after the fact.
Okay.
Did something bad happen? I missed the bad... Oh, it's coming.
It's coming. So it's around 40 minutes into the recording.
Okay. But it's a quote, right?
Oh, it's a quote.
So that's why I'm going to use it, because it was actually a quote.
And who said it?
So... I don't know whether you know, but there's a new protocol that's been added in Vista SMB2. And If you read the Microsoft publicity, it is sort of like, oh, it's this new internet-friendly file system. It's, you know, it's designed to reduce latency. It's the
uncommon internet file system.
And Tridge actually gave a talk on SMB2 and latency at CIF, which I will go into. Anyway, so we weren't sure about this thing. And I ran into a guy who shall remain nameless for this podcast anyway.
Bill Gates.
No, who left Microsoft. Hey, it could be Bill Gates. He's left Microsoft.
Yes, well, not really.
But he was a fairly senior person at Microsoft who had left to form to join an open source company. And we were chatting about SMB2, and he just sort of shook his head, and he said, do you know why we did that? I said, no. He said, yeah, well, the engineers were told to, and I quote, "fuck with Samba."
And that, you know, this, like the whole spec.
This is the whole
SMB2.
Spec for SMB2 is f*** with Samba. So, I was a little cynical about this when I ran into the Microsoft guy at the
CIF. I can't imagine why you'd be cynical about that.
Yeah, when he started going in about how wonderful the latency was, you know, and how it was an improvement. And so Tridge actually did an analysis of this where he looked at the original SMB protocol and the amount of packets it would take to do something simple, like, say, delete a file. Mm-hmm. And it's one packet for the delete request, one packet for the delete reply. Mm-hmm. So in SMB2, if you type the same command on the Windows command line and you sniff the network, you get, I think it's 6 or 8 packets. You get an open, reply, get file information, reply, set file information to delete, reply, then a close, and that actually unlinks it. So you get, what's that, 6 or 8? I think that's like 8 packets or whatever.
Well, bidirectional, right, yeah.
And remember, on a wide area network link, each of those packets is like a 200, 500 millisecond round turn.
Right, so that could take a good second and a half on a large
so,
link.
So essentially, from, you know, going from a round trip time of maybe, you know, 400 milliseconds, they've taken it to about sort of 2,000 milliseconds or 1,600. So, essentially,
so if you're on the East Coast and the file server is on the West Coast,
it's going to be slower.
It's going to be much slower.
And, you know, he brings up Explorer.
Well, it's going to be slower just in your local net, too.
That was just from a command line prompt. So he then brings up Windows Explorer and says, okay, well, how do most people do this? So he right-clicks on the file, hits delete, you know, and finishes. Guess how many packets?
20.
1,500.
What?
Whoa.
1,500.
What the hell is it talking about?
It's got to make sure
this is like a real improvement.
Oh, yeah, girly, I would like to click on a button now. You may click on a button, sir.
No, it goes something like this. It's like, okay, let me...
I don't think we have time.
Well, it's like, let me open the directory. Let me scan every file in it. Let me check on every single attribute. Let me open the file. Let me scan the directory again because something might have changed. Then you see how these things go.
Wow.
It's just... So
it's going to destroy network bandwidth inside...
Yeah, so you look at this thing, and you look at the PR stuff they've put out about how, you know,
fabulous,
they've got 25 times the performance order. And yeah, because the one thing that they did was they increased the read and write integer count from 16 bits to 32, so you can do 32-bit writes. So theoretically, you can do 4 gig writes at one go. So yes, for that might be a little better. But if you look at the rest of it, it's just appalling. So, I mean, Vista, well, yeah. I mean, we're tracking it. There's an implementation in Samba 4 of SMB2. Volker's looking at bringing that back to the production release. So we'll be ready when we need it, but it's, you know, let's just say, yeah, it's not the world's best engineering.
So let me ask you something. So with Vista coming out,
it did accomplish its main goal, did it not?
Samba.
which was to take Tridge about 6 months or so to actually get to work out how it worked.
And he did do that.
He did do that, yeah. So they burned 6 months of his time. So they probably sent 10 engineers a couple of years on that. So, but hey, when you're talking Tridge time, that's, you know.
That's remarkable.
That's a lot of time.
To slow Tridge down for 6 months, that's
it takes
probably,
people. It takes millions of dollars.
That's probably worth millions
of
dollars.
20 engineers for 2 years burdened. I mean, that's a cost of about $5 million.
Well, probably.
You know?
Who knows?
So they had to spend $5 million to waste 6 months of Tridge's time while he's sitting there in his beautiful house there in Canberra, chilling out, you know. And
but he finds that stuff fun, so they actually gave him a lot of fun things to do. I must admit, there were
he's
other
a brilliant
people.
Reverse engineer.
Ronnie Salberg of EMC, who's one of the people behind ethereal.
Sure, the network sniffer. Yeah,
now renamed the awful Wireshark, so I refuse to call it that. Then, of course, there's Metz also in the Samba team. So those three guys are the ones who did most of the work working at Highwood. We never use the word reverse engineering. That's a bad, bad word, Chris.
Why is it a bad word?
We never use the word reverse engineering because reverse engineering... So let me explain how Samba is created. People say, oh man, you evil cloners, or this is a popular phrase from Bill Hill, Microsoft's anti-open source guy. You evil cloners, they take our technology and they just clone it. Well, so standard reverse
engineering... How dare you add numbers using the plus sign?
That's patented. What we do, the standard reverse engineering is when you take something and you disassemble the code. So you run it through a disassembler and you look at it and you work out how it worked. You know, I think commonly the BIOS on the IBM PC was done that way.
The Phoenix, yeah.
But we don't do that. Essentially because that is, because of our wonderful laws in the US, DMCA and other things, I think that actually may be illegal in the US now.
It's only illegal when you have encryptions. Basically, if it can be encrypted as part of that thing and you break the encryption to do it, then you're in a questionable area. But it's only around copyrighted content.
And so. of course, that's, you know, encryption is something that you generally do for authentication.
That's right.
So anyway, so we never ever do that. We never ever disassemble code. What we do is we probe a Windows box. So we write test tools. We see what comes out of a Windows box. And when I say what comes out of a Windows box, I'm talking about what are the pattern of bytes that you see on the wire. So we look at that, we analyze that, and then we write tools that basically say, okay, let's take that pattern of bytes and send it back. The best way of describing it is Tritch did this wonderful paper called the French Cafe technique. It's like, if you were in France, you were sat in a cafe, how would you learn how to speak French? So you listen to other people talking to the waiters, and then a waiter comes up to you, and you basically you parrot what
café con leche, s'il vous plaît.
Café au lait, s'il vous plaît, and you see what gets brought back, and then it's like
Italian.
I'm English. We don't speak any other languages.
S'il vous plaît.
He's sorry, Chris. He's German. You know,
to a German, everything's Italian. I think.
Yeah.
Everything so, that's not German is Italian.
So it's like, well, that was great. I got a coffee, but what I really want is a donut. So you try replacing some of the words and see what you get
beignet,
back.
S'il vous plaît.
Okay.
So it's not exactly reverse engineering, but it is.
It's what we call it is network analysis.
Yeah.
So you know, and then you say something and somebody comes up and slaps your face and it's like, oh, that was a bad word. We shouldn't use that word. Or, you know, and
what word would that be?
Well,
to beep it again. Just so
it's a way people have of figuring out interfaces just to try it. Just throw stuff at it until it and see what the responses are.
And the problem with earlier versions of Windows has gotten a lot better at this, but with earlier versions of Windows, the problem with doing that is that you would then have to reboot the box.
Yeah, if you broke it, you'd have to reboot, right?
Because we used to break it a lot.
Right.
You know, you're laughing, but I remember when we worked closer together, and it's every time I'd come over, it's like, oh, he's rebooting again. It's like you spent the whole time in that damn button. It's like, I wanted to get you a foot switch for it.
we did have some stuff for a while that was basically, you know, a guaranteed Windows killer.
Yeah, no, that was great. He's like, hey, Chris, come here. And I was like, what? And it was like, hit Windows enter. 2003. Wow. He's like, hit that button. I hit it. And like the machine that was Windows just goes, pew.
Windows 2000, pew. Pew.
Pew.
And it's just a malformed packet. It's just, that's all.
Yeah, basically.
But the thing is, you know, he had told them about it. You know, you told them about it for, you know, five,
well,
6 years ahead of time.
They've gotten a lot better at that.
Oh, they have.
They have gotten a lot better at that. You know, SMB2 is what makes it blue screen now.
But
that's new code.
That's not
a
bug. It's a feature. So, but it seems to me that that's probably an easier way than reverse engineering all the code, just because all you have to do is match the interface.
Well, yeah, but the problem is you get a random stream of bytes out, and then you have to work out, well, what does that actually mean?
Right.
And that's where basically the sort of 15 years or so of experience of looking at something and going, oh, that's a user identifier. That's probably a length field. That's probably, you just get used to doing this stuff.
But it must be kind of fun, too. It's like detective work.
Oh, it's so much fun.
Oh, it is fun. Yeah, yeah. I mean, again, this is why we do it.
This is actually how I got into computer programming. I was playing, you remember Rogue on the PC?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so I was playing Rogue, but I didn't have any instructions. Yeah. None, right? Because, you know, why would I have them, right? I downloaded off some BBS. So I'm playing this thing, and I'm hitting buttons, basically, to try to get it to run. And this is why I still use VI to this
day.
And it was doing stuff, right? Yeah. And so I had this notebook, and I was just writing everything down, right?
That's great.
Right? I'd hit a button. I found out you could use characters. Oh, yeah, I could use characters. Cool. I could use Shift, did different things if I hit X versus not, right? And you know what was the last key I found? The help button. I remember when I got that far, and I'm like,
"What are the odds of that?
Are you kidding me?
They tell you everything.
I bang my head on this thing for months, you know? Find every stupid command.
They tell you everything.
That's great, yeah.
So I got started, basically. I'm still a gamer.
12, you know?
I love playing games.
Sure,
I'm
sure.
Still,
you know, I was playing yesterday with Fallout.
Oh,
Fallout 2.
Fallout, wow.
Cool stuff. I was replaying it. It was so cool.
I have the world's sickest collection of shoot 'em up violent games.
He's a huge first-person shooter fan.
Yeah. But I first
even,
started...
like, terrible ones like Judge Dredd and...
stuff. Hey, if you can...
I am the law. I am the law.
When I asked Chris what I should send you to apologize for losing the first two interviews, he said, I wanted to send you a gift basket. He said, well, send him a gift basket with first-person shooters in it. And I said, I don't think they make such a thing, but...
Well, the only problem with I own only play on Linux these days.
So you have to find the ones
I have to find
today,
the ones that'll work with the trans gaming stuff, and you know. But now I first started playing Elite on the BBC Micro.
Wow,
and
check
I
your old crap
loved,
out.
I love that stuff. And what happened was I realized it was copy protected. And
did that stop
I,
you?
No, I'd already bought it.
Yeah.
No, I'd already bought it, but I was just irritated by the fact that I'm like they didn't want me to make a copy. And it just kind of pissed me off, you know? That's like, how dare they say, I can't do what I want to do with this thing. So that was actually how I got into assembly language programming, because I wanted to find the thing that checked for the protected version on the tape and essentially made it skip over that byte. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did.
I've done that in
actually
a few
how I got
programs.
Into it.
Yeah. was how you would get around it. You just
and that
the
was,
jump.
So can we do the whole sort of, The England in the 1980s thing.
Sure.
Oh, thank you, Chris. You know how I love that.
Well, I think it's important for people to see where our friends in open source come from.
So there was an entire period in the 1980s before the IBM PC of immense creativity in Britain, where, you know, people just tried all sorts of weird stuff as home PCs. I mean, there was
computers made of clay.
Yeah. Well, there was a home PC that had, instead of BASIC as its language, it had Forth. Yeah.
Really? Weird.
Yeah, the Jupiter Ace.
All the Germans were going, yeah, Forth!
Woo! Telescope control with a rubber keyboard. And, you know, there was just this incredible creativity. And so there's a whole generation of people in England who grew up just... doing all sorts of soldering little joysticks into the back. There were hardware projects you could do, you know. And then the IBM PC came out and just rolled over everything like a tank, just crushed it under the treads, you know.
Like in Terminator.
Just stultifying conformity. Yeah, like the skulls in Terminator. Pow, you know, and just annihilated everything in there. But it was an incredible learning environment. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why I work on open code. And, you know, I dislike... You know, Windows isn't so bad. I mean, I used to program Windows. It's a way to make a living or whatever. But it's a black box. It rattles when you pick it up, you know, and you got no clue why. And I want to, you know, I want people to have the same opportunities that I had. I mean, my favorite machine was a Sinclair QL 6808 machine, internally 32-bit, external 8-bit bus. And the entire OS... you know, listing, OS listing in assembler with comments was published. It was just available. Yeah. That was the standard way of doing things, you know, because they didn't want to restrict what people could do because they didn't know what people were going to do with these things. And now look at it, you know, oh, a new version of Windows Media has come out. We're restricting the number of copies you
I
can make from
Windows
3
Media
to
11.
2.
You know, they basically broke all the old Windows Media stuff. So if you've already bought a lot of Windows Media stuff, you're just screwed.
Chris, you are not their customer.
Yeah, I know.
The media companies are their customer.
I know.
You are a side effect.
I'm a side effect, Leo.
I prefer to think of you as a cow contentedly chewing the grass the media companies
feed you. Hey, you know, I'm losing weight. You should feel
and then, and then the money comes out of his udders. That's
exactly.
Amazing.
Exactly.
Seen it.
Okay, that was really creepy, both of you. I think you should reconsider your metaphors. I'm just saying.
That's how people are considered these days, and it sucks. It absolutely sucks. And, you know, open source free software is a way of getting back to basics, to the environment that I grew up in.
And let me give you a warning, he says, going on his rant. So, I mean, you know, the way things are going, and I keep trying to point this out at my parents, is that, you know, eventually a doorknob is going to have an embedded processor. When you want to open the door, you put your hand around it, it'll recognize who you are and decide whether you, you know, can get through or not. If the software that we have to control our lives isn't open and isn't available to everybody, then, you know, there's a wonderful science fiction author I love called Werner Vinge, and he had a marvelous quote in one of his books, just a throwaway quote.
He's a hell of a nice guy, you know.
Yeah, I'd love to meet him.
Let's go up to Seattle.
Cool.
I know, we can hang out.
We'll do that. Yeah. Anyway, so a quote in one of his books is just a throwaway quote from someone said in the far future, talking about planetary civilizations, and somebody just says, yeah, the worst tyrannies are always the ones where government-approved code has to run in every node on the network.
That's in a book?
That's in a book.
Wow.
Yeah. And that just really sums up the world that we will be building if we allow, you know, the Windows Media 11 or whatever. If we allow Hollywood to control our machine.
Right, right. Jeremy, you're the three best interviews I've ever done.
Oh, thank you. It's a shame about the other two, but
it is. This is very good.
You know what? Goldfinger says: the first time happenstance, second time coincidence, third time enemy action.
Goldfinger.
I don't remember
Goldfinger.
That.
James, but do you not read James Bond?
I read it all.
It's been a long time since I've read it. That's
all. But I was a lot younger. Yeah.
You're like giving me this look like I'm an alien.
Well, you know, just you know. Man, you should remember the quotes.
He didn't say that in the movie, see, so that's why we don't
know. Do you expect me to read that, look, Mr. Bond?
No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die. I mean, you know that I never have an original thought in my life. I just regurgitate the quotes of other people. So,
you could do worse. You really could. As long as you pick the people well. Thank you, Jeremy. I really appreciate it.
Oh, no problem, Leo. Thanks a lot.